shutdown, state may not notice. Rather than hashing out a deal with the General Assembly, Governor Bruce Rauner last week first accused the Democratic leaders of breaking state ethics laws and then, during a stop in Decatur, cast them as part of the Chicago machine. I'm no expert on negotiation tactics, but that doesn't seem like a recipe for success when it comes to finding common ground and solving problems. So as we tick down the hours of the state's fiscal year, we're left with the threat of a government shutdown when the state's new fiscal year begins July 1st without a budget in place. While a shutdown would trigger a political maelstrom, it's not clear yet how much of an effect such a move would have on most Illinoisans. There are so many laws and court rulings that bar Rauner from shutting certain programs down, some people might not even notice the difference. Although Rauner could close state parks, historic sites, and welfare offices, there are a lot of things he cannot shut down. Let's take a look at those. He can't shut down the Capitol. The building is under the management of Illinois Secretary of State Jesse White, a Democrat. Of course, White could go along with it, but that would mean shutting legislators and reporters out of their offices, too. Rauner cannot close state prisons, developmental centers, mental health facilities, or youth detention centers. He might be able to keep non-emergency personnel from going to work, but facilities that care for or guard human lives cannot be shut down. The governor cannot unilaterally freeze the court system. That is a different branch of government. Same goes for the General Assembly. The state police also are considered emergency personnel and would not be completely pulled off the highways. Of course, the longer a shutdown lasts, the more evident it would become on Illinoisans. And if you combine a shutdown with the possibility of a strike or lockout of the state's unionized workforce, the situation will become a free-for-all. While Rauner spent last week trying to set up a scenario in which Democrats are to blame for the tough decisions he has made, Democrats believe it will be Rauner who will wear the collar for a shutdown. After all, the governor holds the power to shut things down. Lawmakers don't. The schedule. The House and Senate return to the Capitol on Tuesday as part of their overtime schedule. If things go like they did last week, expect more theater and message sending from both chambers and the governor. Last week, Democrats who control the House and the Senate used the day to highlight Rauner's push for a property tax freeze. It was all designed to show the governor that there's not enough support for some of the add-ons he wants. For his part, the governor held a news conference at the Executive Mansion. The setup was odd. Rauner was at the Capitol. Reporters based in the Capitol had to walk past his waiting SUV located at the south loading dock doors. The governor departed the Capitol, rode in the SUV to the mansion, held his news conference, and then returned to the Capitol. It was not clear why he didn't just talk with reporters in his office on the second floor of the State House. Making hay. Some ideas sound good on paper, but don't translate well in the real world. As lawmakers and Rauner frantically search for politically safe ways to save money to generate revenue to fill a $3 billion hole, I was reminded of a 2009 law push by Republican U.S. Representative Mike Bost of Murfreesboro, back when he was a member of the Illinois House. Bost's legislation would allow farmers to contract with the Illinois Department of Transportation to harvest hay beside roads near their farms. In his mind, such a plan could make a dent in the estimated $10 million Department of Transportation spends on moving each year. Department of Transportation and farm groups were somewhat tepid to the idea, citing concerns about safety and need. As it turns out, the program hasn't made much of a dent in state mowing bills. According to the Department of Transportation, there were only a total of 6 permits issued last year in McHenry, Stephenson, Knox, Ogle, and Coles counties. The discussion of college costs is next up for the legislature. The Illinois Senate is scheduled to hold a hearing on college affordability today, Tuesday, as part of their summer overtime session. With 2 weeks to go before the state enters a new fiscal year without a budget in place, the Senate hearing is expected to mirror one held last week on property taxes, in which witnesses testified before the entire Senate on the positive and negative effects of freezing property taxes. The hearing is designed to highlight another difference between the Republican Governor Bruce Rauner and the Democrats who control both chambers of the General Assembly. It's an opportunity for us to talk about ways to turn things around for the middle class, said Rakesha Felin, spokeswoman for the Senate President John Cullerton, Democrat from Chicago. Democrat legislators are battling Rauner over his push to enact business-friendly reforms in exchange for a tax increase that would help close a $3 billion budget gap. After failing to come to an agreement during meetings June 9th, Rauner hit the road last week traveling to Democratic legislative districts in an attempt to pressure rank-and-file members into supporting his agenda. While the Senate discusses the skyrocketing cost of college, members of the House are expected to again take up substantive legislation when they gavel in Tuesday. Steve Brown, a spokesman for the House Speaker Michael Madigan, Democrat, Chicago, wouldn't say what issues are expected to be on the table for the House on Tuesday. "We don't like to negotiate in the media," Brown said. But he added that any legislation is likely to be similar to what the House has done in its past two sessions since the regularly scheduled spring session ended in disarray on May 31st. Along with approving a worker compensation proposal that Rauner said didn't go far enough, the House shot down Rauner's property tax freeze concept. "I think we demonstrated pretty clearly that the governor has failed to persuade many people in Illinois that this is something that is truly needed and truly worth shutting down the government over," Brown said. In a letter to the editor, co-op chairman gives explanation for debt. Shelby Electric Cooperative is being criticized for the $32 million debt that the cooperative has. "The board has to make long-term commitments for facilities and for electric generation that cannot be paid by raising current members' bills. Life expectancy for substations is 30 to 45 years, and as a result of proper maintenance, some of our substations are older than the 45 years. In addition, through its membership in Prairie Power, Inc., the cooperative currently has $7 million invested in the state-of-the-art Prairie State Generating Plant in southern Illinois, including ownership of the coal reserves to fuel the generator for the next 30 years or more. More than 22% of our debt will be paid by money returned from Prairie Power over the next 10 years. At the end of 2014, the cooperative had more than $4.5 million in working capital. Of that amount, $800,000 is invested in materials and supplies, such as transformers, poles, and wire. The cooperative has prepaid to Prairie Power almost $2.15 million for our continuing power costs. Power costs represents 60 to 65% of every dollar we spend. Member equity in the co-op is approaching $25 million, or about 40%. The industry norm is 35 to 50%. In the next 5 years, more than $8.5 million, or 25%, of the total debt is scheduled to be retired. In the past 10 years, nearly $6 million of capital credits have been returned to members. The cooperative spends more than $4 million a year to pay employees that, in turn, spend most of that in our community. Decisions are made in the boardroom, but the employees are the ones who keep the lights on. John M. Scott, Chairman of the Board, Shelby Electric Cooperative, Pena. Another letter to the editor. Raising taxes won't solve social problems. Barbara Minnick says anyone opposed to her views doesn't care if there's enough money for schools, child care assistance for single working mothers, a daycare program that gives homeless people some assistance, or... She blames this on morality, religion, and Republicans. She is wrong. In the 1960s, four of us were raised in poverty by our single working mother. No child support, no government assistance or health insurance. I learned to work and be responsible for myself. The Marine Corps allowed this kid from the ghetto to enlist and taught me a profession. Teaching the poor to support themselves is more beneficial than giving them lots of entitlements. Many local churches provide food to the needy. The same churches provide emerging financial assistance and clothing. Several homeless shelters are run by Christian organizations. Churches run resale shops that provide quality clothing and other goods to anyone choosing to shop. The Democratic Party, the Republican Party, and AFSCME don't do any of this. Why don't they take an active role in helping people? Do we raise taxes and not address the reasons the state is bankrupt? That would change the spending habits of the government or those receiving government assistance. Fix the problems. Don't blame a lack of support for a welfare state on morality or religion. Blame it on the results of the war on poverty. Kevin Brobst, Oriana. And here's an editorial. Stop ghost payrolling practice. Beth Purvis is Governor Bruce Rauner's chief advisor on education issues. But her pay comes out of the Department of Human Services, which is the state's top welfare agency. That doesn't make sense and is an issue Rauner should correct. However, complaints from Democrats in the General Assembly about this process, called ghost payrolling, are hypocritical at best. The act of paying staffers out of various departments to make budgets look better has been going on for decades. Governor Rod Blagojevich did it. Governor Pat Quinn did it. Democrats were silent about the practice at that time. So the most amazing part of the Democrats' dog and pony show last week was they managed to act like it was a big issue with a straight face. The Democrats also complained about the $250,000 salary that Purvis draws. That's admittedly a lot of money, but about 20 school superintendents in the state make more than that, so maybe it's not so far out of line. By the way, there are also many top-level Democratic staffers in the General Assembly who make salaries in the six-figure range. The act of ghost payrolling doesn't have any impact on the state's budget in the final analysis. It doesn't make any difference if employees are paid out of one department or another. What's lost in the practice, and it's a significant loss, is transparency. Any citizen should be able to examine the state's budget with confidence that the numbers reflect what's really happening. That is far from the case in Illinois for a lot of reasons. But it doesn't help the process to have people paid out of departments that have little or nothing to do with their jobs. That's one of the many reasons that the state's financial situation is so deplorable. The state's budget has been manipulated for so many years that it's difficult to get an accurate assessment of what's being spent where. Ghost payrolling is a small part of the problem, but the governor can lead by example. If Rauner believes he needs a highly paid education advisor, he shouldn't be afraid to put it in the education budget and defend it. Shuffling employee expenses simply makes it look he has something to hide. Ghost payrolling was a bad practice when it was performed by previous governors. It's a bad practice now, and one that Rauner should bring to a screeching halt. Rauner came into office promising to change Springfield. We'd remind the governor that Springfield isn't going to change if he follows the bad practices of the leaders that preceded him. And here's another editorial. Clinton's response avoids real answers. It had a familiar ring. I don't ever know what people's motives are, said former President Bill Clinton, prompting one to pause and consider what the definition of motives is. Indeed, one doesn't ever know. But when a country or a firm gives large sums of money to a charity founded by a former U.S. president whose wife happens to be Secretary of State and whose department may be considering business related to said donor, then one would not likely infer purely altruistic motives. The former president's remarks were made during a recent interview with CNN's Jake Tapper, during which he was asked about some of the donations that have come into question since Hillary Clinton announced her presidential run. Were some donors perhaps trying to curry favor with then-Secretary of State? This was the thesis of the recent book Clinton Cash by Peter Schweitzer, which was made conservative rounds in recent weeks. Whether there's anything shady to the fees beyond the sheer greed remains unclear. It could also be non-existent, but let's review. Schweitzer found that Bill Clinton's fees increased significantly from his $100,000 to $200,000 engagement shortly after leaving office to several above $500,000 or at least one at $750,000. 11 of the 13 speeches for which he was paid over $500,000 were during his wife's tenure at the State Department. Bill Clinton is no silver-tongued devil. His words drip with gold, apparently. But that as it may be, it seems a stretch that a $550,000 speaking fee to Clinton in China was connected to the It seems a stretch that a $550,000 speaking fee to China from China to Clinton was connected to the Obama administration's Asia pivot, as some conservative outlets have suggested. Even so, Caesar's wife, who must always be above suspicion, was not well served by this and other financial exchanges that have come to light. Disclaimer: no one denies that the Bill, Hillary, and Chelsea Clinton Foundation has done much good in the world, from fighting AIDS in Africa to rehabilitating Haiti after the devastating 2010 earthquake. There's no requirement that public officials use their status to improve the world, and Bill Clinton found a way both to better the lives of others and enrich himself. A fine and compassionate capitalist is he. Still, any urchin who ever helped a princess step across a puddle understands that rewards accrue to those who play nice with the powerful. Some may call this politics, others influence peddling. The difference doubtless lies in a definition somewhere, but one thing is clear: making a foundation contribution or paying the Secretary of State's husband to say a few words is a good investment. In his response during the CNN interview, Clinton said that people donated to the foundation because they wanted to help, citing Haiti as an example. But not all cases are so straightforward. The New York Times explored an example that seems at least quid pro quo-ish. You'll need a dot connecting app for this. Around the same time, an interagency committee that included Hillary Clinton's State Department was reviewing the sale of a uranium mining company, Uranium One, to a Russian firm. The Clinton Foundation received millions of dollars from people with ties to the mining company's chairman. Then, shortly after the Russians announced their intention to acquire a majority stake in Uranium One, Mr. Clinton received $500,000 for a Moscow speech from a Russian investment bank with links to the Kremlin that was promoting Uranium One stock, according to the Times. This isn't an obvious case of influence massaging, nor does it seem necessary to say, follow the money. Such complex relationships involving Hillary Clinton, her family's charitable foundation, hundreds of millions in fees and donations, a former president, a secretary of state, and a possible next president, all embodied in just two people who happen to be married to each other, are certainly enough to attract a reporter's attention and a voter's skepticism. Never mind the 30,000 emails Hillary Clinton deleted from the personal server she used while leading the State Department. With only Bill Clinton responding to questions and polls showing Clinton's trustworthiness in decline, Democrats have cause for concern. Yet again, it seems that Bill Clinton only makes things worse when he tries to help his wife. Has anyone proved that we did anything objectionable? He asked during a recent Bloomberg News interview. Well, no. But citing an absence of proof is an odd way of asserting one's ethical purity. It seems perhaps too defensive and is legal speak by someone who knows how to operate just inside the margin of error. This is an editorial, Justice and Capital Punishment. To the Honorable Antonin G. Scalia, Associate Justice of the Supreme Court of the United States. Dear Sir, 21 years ago, your then colleague, the late Justice Harry Blackmun, wrote what became a famous dissent to a Supreme Court decision not to review a Texas death penalty conviction. In it, Blackmun declared that he had become convinced the death penalty experiment has failed and said he considered capital punishment irretrievably unconstitutional. The death penalty, he wrote, remains fraught with arbitrariness, discrimination, and mistake. From this day forward, I no longer shall tinker with the machinery of death. You mocked him for this stance in an opinion concurring that the majority, invoking as justification for capital punishment the horrific 1983 case of an 11-year-old girl who was raped, then killed by having her panties stuffed down her throat. How enviable a quiet death by lethal injection, you wrote, compared with that. A few months later, the very case you had referenced came before the court, Henry Lee McCollum, a mentally disabled man who was on death row in North Carolina after having been convicted of that rape and murder. Apply to the court for a review of his case. You were part of the majority that rejected the request without comment. The demagoguery of your response to Justice Blackmun is pretty standard for proponents of state-sanctioned death. Rather than contend with the many logical and irrefutable arguments against capital punishment, they use a brute force appeal to emotion. Certain crimes, they say, are so awful, heinous, and vile that they cry out for the ultimate sanction. As you have doubtless heard, it now turns out McCollum was innocent of that crime. Last year, he and his also mentally disabled half-brother, Leon Brown, who had been serving a life sentence, were exonerated by DNA evidence and set free. The case against him was never what you'd call ironclad. No physical evidence tied him to the crime. The centerpiece of the prosecution's case was a confession McCollum, then a 19-year-old, said to have the mentality of a child 10 years younger, gave no lawyer present after 5 hours of questioning. "I had never been under this much pressure," he told the News and Observer newspaper in a videotaped death row interview. "With a person hollering at me and threatening me, I just made up a false story so they could let me go home." But he didn't go home for over 30 years. You and your colleagues had a chance to intervene in that injustice and chose not to. Not incidentally, the real culprit avoided accountability all that time. The argument against the death penalty will never have the visceral, immediate emotionalism of the argument in favor. It does not satisfy the instinctive human need to make somebody pay when something bad has been done. Rather, it turns on quieter concerns, issues of inherent racial, class, geographic, and gender bias, issues of corner-cutting cops and ineffective counsel, and issues of irrevocability, the fact that, once imposed, death cannot be undone. Those issues were easy for you to ignore in mocking Blackmun. They're always easy to ignore, right up until the moment they are not. This is one of those moments, sir, and it raises a simple and obvious question to which one would hope you feel honor-bound to respond. In 1994, you used this case as a symbol of why we need the death penalty. What do you think it symbolizes now? We'll move to obituaries. Robert C. Bassnett, 56, of Decatur, passed away on Saturday, June 13, 2015, at Decatur Memorial Hospital. Funeral services will be held Wednesday, June 17, at 11 a.m. at the Brintlinger and Earl Funeral Home in Decatur, with visitation 2 hours prior. Burial will be at North Fork Cemetery, Decatur, and memorials may be made to the Good Samaritan Inn. Condolences may be left to the family in care of Brintlinger and Earl Funeral Home at www.brintlingerandearl.com. And I'll spell that. It's www.brintlingerandearl.com. Verna May Lewis Cooper, 79, of Decatur, died on Saturday, June 13, 2015, at Decatur Memorial Hospital, surrounded by family and friends. Services to celebrate Verna's life will be held at 3 p.m. on Friday, June 19th, at Dawson and Wyckoff Westwood Street Funeral Home. Visitation will be 1 hour prior to the services. Messages of condolence may be sent to the family at www.dawson-wyckoff.com, and that's dawson-wyckoff. Glenda Sue Deering, 70, of Decatur, passed away on Friday, June 12th, at Memorial Medical Center in Springfield. A service to celebrate Glenda's life will be held at 11 a.m. on Thursday, June 18th at Dawson and Wyckoff North Chapel. Glenda will be laid to rest in Macon County Memorial Park. Memorial contributions may be directed to Decatur Memorial Hospital. Visitation will be 1 hour prior to the service. And condolences may be sent to the family at www.dawson-wyckoff.com. And that's DAWSON-WIKOFF. Larry S. Glenn of Corvallis, Oregon, formerly of Clinton, passed away Sunday, June 7th. Cremation rites have been accorded. Memorial contributions may be made to the Larry Glenn Memorial Fund and should be sent care of Ross Glenn, and that's G-L-E-N-N, 910 South Highway B, as in boy, East Prairie, Missouri, 63845, or can be given to Wounded Warriors Project. A celebration of life gathering for that will be held at Calvert Funeral Home in Clinton from 1 to 2:30 p.m. on Thursday, June 18th. Burial with military honors will be held at 3 p.m. at Baptist Cemetery in Kenny. Beano Green departed this life June 12, 2015, while Eastview Terrace in Sullivan. Services to celebrate Beano's life will be 11 a.m. Thursday, June 18th, at Morin and Gable Funeral Home. Visitation will be 1 hour prior to the funeral services. Burial with military rites will be held at a later date in Camp Butler National Cemetery in Springfield. Send online condolences and share memories to the family at www.morinandgable.com, and I'll spell that, it's all one word, MORANANDGOEBEL, www.morinandgable.com. Paul Eugene Krenline of Mohiqua died June 13th in St. Mary's Hospital in Decatur. Graveside services will be 10:30 a.m. on Thursday, June 18th, 2015, in Odd Fellows Cemetery, Mohiqua. Visitation will be 6 to 8 Wednesday, June 17th, in Sites Funeral Home, Mohiqua. And Masonic services will follow at 8 p.m. Memorials may be made to the Shriners Children's Hospital. And condolences for the family may be left at www.seits.com. Let me spell that. www.seit, as in Thomas, Z as in zebra, F as in Frank, H.com. Laverna P. Wilson, 91 of Decatur, passed away Sunday, June 14th at McKinley Court Nursing Home. Funeral services will be 2 p.m. Thursday, June 18th at Brintlinger and Earl Funeral Home, with visitation beginning at 1 p.m. Burial will be in Graceland Cemetery. Condolences may be left to the family in care of Brintlinger and Earl Funeral Home at www.brintlingerandearl.com. Thank you for listening to Radio Reader. This has been the Decatur Herald and Review, and today this is Naomi Jacobson reading it with you. Thank you again.